So it's Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, it's time for office hour. So before we begin, you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And as happens every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, this is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we go out around the campus and knock on people's doors to find out what's going on in this big campus. What's everybody doing in their offices there? What are they studying? What are they thinking about? What are they investigating that we can learn and get our own college education from meeting these people and finding what makes them tick? So can you hear me there? I'm knocking on the door. And today I'm very excited to be knocking on the door in the law school, which we haven't had that many people. And of course, Davis has this wonderful law school. So I'm very happy. Today we have Lisa Ikemoto from the law school. So welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you.
Yes. And Lisa works at the intersection between law and reproductive rights and all kinds of issues with women's health and fertility and abortion. So we have a whole potpourri of quite complicated issues to talk about. But as always, before we turn specifically to her study of the legal issues around women's reproductive health and fertility, we always ask our guests how it is that they became interested in the particular area that they study, and what is it about this intersection of law, and how does someone end up in the law school, but not only ending up in the law school and studying law, but studying a rather particular subcategory of law that you might, for example, be studying in the women's studies program, for example, but instead you're at the legal end of it. So how did you get in this particular area of research?
I think there's sort of it's a two-part answer. So the first part is I came of age right when women's rights were being developed in the courts and in the legislatures, and reproductive rights in particular were being recognized by the Supreme Court. And I think the other part of it is that, I think the other part of it is that while I was in law school, the fertility industry was in formation, and one of the first writing projects I did was about surrogacy.
Surrogacy. Mm-hmm. And this was happening, so you were already committed to law.
At that point, yeah. Mm-hmm. I went into law school thinking that I might be interested in business law. After a couple years, realized that I wasn't. But I took this great course called bioethics, which was relatively new at that time. And in that course, I wrote a paper about surrogacy. And this was in the late 1980s, and during that period, surrogacy was relatively new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that even though it was relatively new to you, there was going to be a whole lot of law in this area.
Yeah, or the absence of law. And that's part of what interests me about the many bioethics issues that I look at and some of the reproductive rights issues that I look at as well. Is that sometimes the practices and the technologies that roll out in a highly commercialized way without sort of existing law.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sometimes other issues like abortion are sort of the opposite, right? They're so highly regulated that they're treated sort of segregated from the rest of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So and we will see that in the specific topics we talk about today, so it's an interesting point to start with, that we will see some areas in which there's a huge amount of regulation and on other areas where you might expect there to be more regulation than there is. So it's a whole quilt, a crazy quilt of women's reproductive health out there. So terrific. So, and I bet it's kept you busy ever since then, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because
very busy.
There's a ton of stuff going on that I think will be quite interesting to our listening audience. But I want to start off with sort of I guess there's many dark sides to the topics we're going to talk about today. But certainly one of the darker phases, which doesn't really date from when you were in law school, it really is much older, is the idea of forced infertility, where the federal government comes in and decides that women should have a surgery and basically no longer be able to reproduce, and forced sterilization. And I think that part of the American history, but I think it's one that we don't actually talk about very much. And I was very struck when I was looking over your article about this, that this is something that I sort of vaguely knew about, but I didn't know very much. So I think we should just start for the listening audience, telling them a little bit about the history of forced sterilization in the United States. You talk about it going back into the 1920s, And
or earlier, yeah, the very beginning of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Would be the first cases. And how does this come into the courts? I mean, how does it happen that this gets litigated? I mean, in some ways you'd think it's an odd thing to be litigated.
Yeah, the very first cases that came up, or the very first sort of practice of forced sterilization, occurred as part of the eugenics movement in the United States and in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in the United States, there was a huge movement for the practice of eugenics in all different forms. And one of the major sort of tools of this goal of improving society's gene pool was not just encouraging sort of the so-called right people to procreate, but discouraging or preventing the so-called wrong people from procreating. And forced sterilizations were part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so states passed laws in the early part of the 20th century that authorized doctors and certain institutions to sterilize people against their will. So both vasectomies and tubal ligations.
Right. So, but it was primarily, I would imagine it was primarily female sterilization generally, or it, what would you say?
Yeah, in the first part of the 20th century was actually both. So it became first possible to surgically sterilize men. The vasectomy procedure was developed.
Simple?
Yeah, it's simpler. It was developed in a prison in Indiana, and that sort of spurred the idea of eugenic sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
And then sterilizing women was a little bit more complicated just because the surgical procedure is more complicated. It's much more invasive and dangerous.
Yes.
And sort of different surgical procedures have sort of evolved over time, but that was introduced shortly after, also in the very early part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So it may be just to help a little bit with the idea of, we've all heard the term eugenics, but sort of what was the idea here was one of sort of taking the idea from science, the development of the more sophisticated ideas of genetics, and then somehow wedding that to a sort of a social theory that some genes are better than others, and then feeling that you have to actually be very active in order to improve. I remember somebody taking me aside once and telling me, because he knew my uncle who was a doctor, and he was saying, you've got to have children. I was young at the point. He said, you got to have good children. It's like, you're coming from a good gene pool, because he knew my uncle. He was a doctor,
yep.
too.
So those ideas live on.
Exactly. So that's one of the points I want to make, that it's sort of once these ideas get wedded, even if we don't use the idea, we don't use the term as much, there is this kind of sort of notion that we can use science to improve society by moving towards better genes and just generally away from worse genes.
Yeah, I think at that time, and, you know, we see vestiges of this today in different, maybe slightly different forms, but in the late, very end of the 19th century, Theodore Roosevelt used the term race suicide, right? That the right people, the proper educated white people weren't procreating enough, right? And this took place during an influx of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe,
right?
Who were sort of treated as the undesirables of that time. And then as we roll into the 20th century, that list sort of grew of who was undesirable in eugenic terms. So people with disabilities, or at least perceived to have disabilities, people who had committed certain types of crimes.
Poorly educated people.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know sure that they were genetic, they seemed like they maybe, the idea of the feeble-minded, they weren't going to be, well, it would be difficult to educate them well.
Yeah, and sometimes it was people who maybe didn't actually fit those definitions, but they had sort of exceeded social boundaries. They had had sex, right, and had children out of marriage.
Yes.
So that might have been the real reason.
Which must prove bad genes.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. But even though you say that male sterilization is, you know, factually is simpler, most of the cases that you talk about here, beginning in 22 and then the important cases in 1973, when there was still forced sterilization going on in the United States of America, most of those are cases that involve women.
Yeah, that's true. So I trace in that particular article, I trace sort of the different versions of eugenics or different sort of narratives that shape the use of involuntary sterilization from the early 20th century into the late 20th century. And the narratives changed a little bit and the target populations changed a little bit. So by the 1970s, which was the focus of that particular book chapter, the target was largely
low-income women of color.
Uh-huh.
So some of them were white, but most often African-American and Latino.
Mm-hmm. So just to make it clear, in 1973, the case you talk about, Ralph versus Weinberger, is a case of, in my own lifetime, it's amazing to think about it, in which they were basically lying to young women, saying that they were, and not telling them what they were going to do, taking them into hospitals and sterilizing them and then returning them to their parents, who were quite surprised to find out what had happened to them. And this then becomes litigated and
yes.
goes to court.
Yeah, so Ralph versus Weinberger was a class action. The named plaintiff, Katie Ralph, was a teen, a young teen yes. at that time. And she and her two sisters were taken away by a nurse or nurses from a publicly funded health clinic. And their parents weren't told what would happen to the girls. They thought they were getting free health care.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls were taken to a hospital, except for Katie Ralph, who locked herself in the bedroom of their home. But their two younger sisters were taken away and sterilized.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only later the parents found out what happened.
Now, and what state was this in?
That was in Alabama, Montgomery.
Mm-hmm. In Alabama.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So then a lawyer takes the case, and he has his own history of... he was the one, if I remember it right, correct, that had his family had fled the Nazis, and he felt like this was strangely familiar.
Yeah, so the Southern Poverty Law Center was, and the National Welfare Rights Organization took on the plaintiffs in these cases and represented them
mm-hmm.
In the courts. And one of the lead lawyers was the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ironies of the case is that the doctor who had performed the sterilization of the Ralph sisters in this case had been the doctor who delivered him. His mother was angry at him for suing the doctor who had delivered him. So it's a fairly prominent doctor in the community, but he felt entitled to do this for the benefit of society,
mm-hmm.
which is the same kind of justification that sort of harks back to the early days of eugenics.
Well, if we go step back from this case, one of the many interesting things is the idea that you mentioned that the primary responsibility and the primary blame for pregnancy in these cases does rest with the women. And I just think it's worth pausing for a moment and thinking about that, because that principle is so ingrained in our society. I think we almost don't notice it. We almost don't even recognize it, even when it up to not let alone 1973, but right now, the way in which the question of the male role with the whole abortion dilemma is never raised. It's as if somehow there were no men involved and men are not really involved. It kind of reminds me of biblical texts in which women are not involved. You know, those genealogies in which men just begat men one after another in the Bible. And then this is sort of the reverse, in which women sort of just somehow become pregnant and then bear the responsibility and the punishment for it. Whereas the question of the male role, it's just incredible. I mean, I want you to explain to me how that male role is so hidden.
Yeah.
And how do we, what kind of sense have you made it since you've worked through this material so carefully?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really important question, how we get from the fact, the biological fact, that it's the female body that can bear and beget children, to sort of this expanded version that women are primarily responsible for.
And guilty.
Yeah. And guilty often, right? For fertility, birth, and parenting. As well. So in some of my writing, I refer to it as the ideology of motherhood,
mm-hmm.
Where women, it's considered, because of women's biological capacity, women are sort of deemed to have this, not just the role of being a parent to their own child, being mothers to their own child, but to play the role of mother in society,
mm-hmm.
And to sort of carry certain responsibilities, right, which can lead to blame, right, if they're sort of labeled as having done wrong,
mm-hmm,
if
mm-hmm.
they're not selfless enough,
mm-hmm.
right? Sacrificing enough, nurturing enough.
I wonder whether, I mean, this may be a sort of heavy-handed, blatant way to put it, but I'm wondering if it also is a kind of magical thinking by men, that there is a kind of magical thinking, which I've discussed with men in different times in my life, who tried to say, yes, we have magical thinking, and for things like not believing they can get women pregnant. There's a kind of magical thinking among many men that it isn't going to happen to them. You know, that they've heard this thing about getting women, but that women do get pregnant, but somehow it doesn't seem like it's going to happen to them. So I think there's a kind of a magical disowning of pregnancy among men as well. That may be not the kind of thing you in the law school think about, but you may not use the word magical thinking. But it does seem to me that there is a kind of magical thinking here that kind of disowns the male role. The male role is kind of just disowned, in addition to, as you say, the highlighting of the female role, but also the strange disowning of the male role.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't think of it so much on the individual level of what particular men or women are thinking. I mean, certainly women have also thought, well, I won't get pregnant this time.
Yes. There's right? a lot of magical thinking in general around
but
sexuality.
But there's definitely a sort of gendered allocation of roles and responsibility without the accompanying power, right, mm-hmm. to women.
Mm-hmm. So then we've left these poor women locked in the bathroom in 1973, trying to avoid being forced sterilization. Ultimately, they win this. I mean, in some ways, this is a happy story. And in the 70s, they decide that you shouldn't go around forced sterilizing in general. But as you say in the article, it's a long and complicated path to what we would call, you know, the end of any kind of forced issues around fertility.
Yeah, it hasn't. I mean, it's happened again recently, right? So one of the interesting sort of part of the important context is that when you ask people, where do you think these forced sterilizations occurred?
Yeah.
Most people say, oh, it must have been Mississippi.
Yes.
Right. Or some southern state. But actually, there were more forced sterilizations in California than any other state.
Wow. In our own state here.
Yeah.
Are you listening, California? Yes. We had more forced sterilization
it
in our state.
It happened here. And there are, you know, there is an effort right now, an advocacy effort to try to get redress for the women and the men who were sterilized against their will mm-hmm. During this same overlapping period of time.
So the early 70s.
Yeah, but even a few years ago, early in the 21st century, it turned out that involuntary sterilizations were being performed on women in a prison in Central California. So again, California surfaces again in this story. Mm-hmm. Even though we think of ourselves as the liberal rights-protecting state, mm-hmm. It can happen anywhere.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions then I wanted to pose at the end of our discussion about this particular issue is exactly what you're saying. Like, what is the legacy now in 2018? Are there maybe not exactly similar things where you take a young woman and you don't tell her parents, but is there a kind of, government intervention around forced sterilization that those kinds of issues still linger? I know some people use the term forced birthers. I don't know if you've heard that term being used for people who oppose certain reproductive rights for women, with the idea then again, sort of the government coming in and making a strong statement about who can and cannot have a baby at any particular time. So I was going to phrase the question as, you know, who are the Ralphs of 2018? Who are the people whose reproductive capacities are being most intruded on? So one of them we might include still would be women who are in prison as being one of the last groups.
Yeah, there. I think it's still low-income women.
Low-income women.
Women who are immigrants.
Yes.
I think women of color disproportionately are still, and maybe it's not forced sterilization, but maybe the softer form is who we encourage and who we discourage from becoming parents. And one of the issues that's sort of under discussion right now is that there's been a lot of attention and promotion of use of long-acting reversible contraception, like
yes.
IUDs, mm-hmm. right? And they've had great success in enabling women to control their fertility. But one of the concerns is that, you know, are we pushing it on certain populations to the point where they feel like they don't actually have a choice?
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that one of the reasons why Republicans in earlier phase of American society were so much big supporters of Planned Parenthood? Because Planned Parenthood had a kind of an idea behind it that this would help regulate reproduction in a much different way than we think about Planned Parenthood now being sort of a freaky, wacky fringe group, that it actually was sort of, in a way trying to discourage and encourage people to use birth control exactly for the idea of that they not having so many babies.
Yeah, I think the sort of family planning has merged at different times with the idea of population control.
Yes.
And you saw that sometimes it played out with in the context of sterilization, and sometimes it's birth control or other contraceptives, sometimes in other ways, including immigration control.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we have come to the end of the first segment today, so we are going to be back in just a minute, so stay with us and we will return. Welcome back to Office Hour. This is segment number two, and this is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and today we're talking with Lisa Ikemoto from the law school about the interface between the legal system of America and fertility issues. So the next we talked at the beginning about forced sterilization, and now we're going to turn to something that I think many of our listeners have heard something about, more so than forced sterilization, which is the question of eggs as capital and the use of eggs and human egg procurement in the fertility industry today. And I think that's a topic almost everybody I know in some way knows somebody or has been involved with somebody who's been doing egg procurement. So the question then is, from your point of view, to try to help us understand how these issues intersect with the law. Because in some ways you would think they really don't have anything to do with the law. You might think that, right? But you would be quite wrong.
Correct. Yeah. It seems personal.
Yes, exactly. So what we're talking about now is assisted reproductive technology comes along, and in some ways it would seem to be one of the most private issues, but you know, a family, a husband and wife trying to have a child and using assisted reproductive technology, but we find a huge amount of litigation and law about that. And in particular, you talk about the way in which assisted reproductive technology takes sort of the question of eggs and fertility and commodifies it in a way, and it turns eggs into what you would call capital. Maybe you can explain that a little bit, what you mean by eggs being capital. We all know about Das Kapital and Marx, but we didn't think about it. We didn't necessarily think about eggs being part of that.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, biobanking of human cells and tissues, other types of cells and tissues from other living organisms is become not only a practice of the biotechnology industry, but a way of accumulating sort of value in these. So the collection of eggs and sperm, right, from humans is in part a form of biobanking, right? So in the context of the fertility industry, the initial practice was to ask people to provide eggs for the use of others who wanted to have children with them,
it was
to
a
in vitro
nice,
fertilization.
Nice thing to do.
Yeah, it was a nice thing to do, and we still call them egg donors, even though the vast majority of people who provide eggs for others' use are paid for it.
Egg sellers doesn't sound as good.
Right.
Exactly.
Or sometimes we call them egg providers to try to be a little bit more neutral. but there are certainly money is paid, not just to the people who provide the eggs, but to the sort of interveners, the agencies in between. So it's the source of a business.
Mm-hmm. Right? So it just automatically, because it's part of an American capitalistic society, eggs get made into part of the capitalistic society.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to have that operate, then you're going to have laws, because you always have to have laws about this. So you end up having laws. And the central issue, to try to synthesize it for our listeners, it often ends up coming down really to the idea of informed consent. So you pay somebody, but you also get their consent, which I think is a kind of an odd idea. If money is not considered good enough, they also have to be informed. So I want you to talk a little bit about it. I'll tell you, it reminded me of the Greek traditions of animal sacrifice. There was an idea that the animal nodded its head right before it was sacrificed. So an animal gave a sort of informed consent
to be the sacrificial lamb.
Yes, or the sacrificial goat or whatever it was. And the idea of the culture was that the animal actually did, in fact, take this role upon themselves somewhat willingly. So I'm very interested in the way in which the idea of being willing seems to be psychologically and socially very important to culture.
Yeah, I think it's the merging of two legal medical practices. I hadn't actually traced it back to that religious tradition. But I think one is, it's a doctrine of informed consent, which is, you know, a key rule that shapes the doctor-patient relationship. And the egg retrieval process is a medical procedure.
Yes.
So I think in part, it's part that. But what's happened in practice and in law is that informed consent has also become a way of transferring possession and control. So who has the say-so over the use of
the egg.
Of the eggs? Yeah, so it's sort of like it's a bringing together of this sort of, you know, rule that shapes the doctor-patient relationship with contract.
Okay, so in other words, by using informed consent, you have made it clear that the person who donates the eggs is a willing donor. And that as if you don't do that, even if you pay for it, there's always the possibility that somehow society finds repulsive in some way of not having the person want to do it. Whether that's actually really true or not, that's what we want to think. That's my idea. We don't know that those goats really were giving informed consent, but somehow we really like that. But we also have the idea that it is a contract, so that once they've signed it, it's over. You know, that their right to the egg is completely cut off in terms of legality. Is
yeah.
that sort of how you would describe it?
Yeah, and it's probably not the end-all and be-all. It's sort of, if you really want to make that complete, that you also need a family law rule, which says that the person who uses the egg to have a child is the legal parent, irregardless of who provided the egg in the first place.
So you have to make people into parents.
Yeah, but if you think of it as a series of steps that has to happen, the egg comes first, right before the baby.
Right, so you use the phrase that the informed consent is the mechanism that transforms a gift into property. So, and it, otherwise it might just be somebody giving an egg. Now that egg actually belongs and is the closest we could have to actually sort of being part of that family in that way. I'm curious if you could compare that with blood donation. I'm just curious because blood donation is something actually, did an entire course on blood and we talked about modern blood donation just because, again, the symbolic meaning of blood over historical time has been so tremendous and so important. And I think in the case of blood, we moved away from the idea of paying for blood because the idea was that people would rather give blood as a gift. So that seems to be somewhat contradictory to the example you bring of eggs.
Yeah, so we still call them egg donors, even though the people who provide eggs for others' use are not always, but in most cases, they receive payment. There is discomfort or unease expressed with the idea that we're paying for the eggs themselves. Yeah. So typically what the industry says or what the egg agency say is that we're not paying for the eggs. We're paying for the time and effort that it took to provide the eggs, undergo the egg retrieval process. Uh-huh. So really what you're doing is paying for the time and effort rather than the eggs themselves, or at least that's how it's explained, or that's the narrative that's used.
So you're getting the free T-shirt when you give the blood is not a payment for the blood, but it's saying we realize you had to sit there and be uncomfortable and take time out in the afternoon, so we're giving you a free T-shirt.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I'm still curious whether there is, you know, how do we explain the idea about the value in our capitalistic society of a gift, and that some times body part things are really highly valued because they are gifts. I don't know if people do platelet donation and such like that. I assume those people are also not paid for any of those kinds of things, that we have a sort of a societal conflict about whether we want people to give gifts or not. You know? And maybe it's just somehow that that the legal system is going to come in so much around you know, fertility and babies and families, that it's almost that gift is never going to be enough of a societal model. We're going to end up in law much more, and that's why we're going to end up in informed consent.
Well, I think in this case, you know, the law is, in a sense, facilitating the gift model, in this case, or at least giving these transfers the appearance of gift. And at the same time, it does not interfere with placing value on what's received. So the way the law works with respect to the transfer of human cells and tissues from the person who was the source of them, right, to another, is that generally the law says you don't own the cells and tissues. You don't have property in the cells and tissues that are removed from your body. You do have the power to transfer them, typically using the doctrine of informed consent.
Right.
Right. But the person who receives them, right, can treat them as property. Mm-hmm. They have all the say-so over them, and if they turn them into something valuable, then they, in a sense, own them.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that, look, we've wrapped it up as much as we can and tied a bow around it.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to make it look as gift-like because we do value that as a society, but it's just more complicated. And maybe one way to think about it is that informed consent is a way of also wrapping it up in the idea of gift. So that I think that's extremely interesting and makes a lot of sense. Maybe we should talk because that you're, you know, here from the law school. So talk about a particular decision, the Moore decision. I thought that was an interesting one. I think our listeners would be interested in it because it includes the University of California.
Yes.
So here we see the UC being swept up in a law case over the question of procurement of body parts and tissues. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about the Moore decision.
Yeah, it's an interesting case. I'm actually writing about that right now. So the case started in the 1970s. A man named John Moore went to UCLA. He had a diagnosis of hairy cell leukemia. And in the course of treatment, he had serious symptoms of a swollen spleen. And so he was recommended to have surgery to remove his spleen, a splenectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And he consented to that. And the doctor at UCLA removed his spleen. And over the next few years, I think it was 7 years, he regularly was asked to fly down from his home in Washington back to Los Angeles to provide various cell and tissue samples. And he was told that was part of his follow-up treatment.
Mm-hmm.
He had actually been cured of hairy cell leukemia. And it turned out that the doctor and another UCLA researcher had used those cells and tissues to create and cultivate a cell line, which they then patented. And a patent is a property right. So they had created a cell line, obtained a patent on his own cells. So he sued.
How did he find out that they had done this? I'm just curious.
So initially they sent, at some point after he had provided several samples and after he had thought his spleen had been disposed as medical waste, he received a letter saying, oh, could you sign this form giving us all rights to your cells and tissues?
To everything you left behind when you visited last
time.
Yeah,
and so he asked questions he found a lawyer who asked more questions and discovered that there was a patent had been filed,
mm-hmm.
A patent application. It was then that they discovered what had happened.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with the case?
So the case made its way up to the California Supreme Court, which issued a decision. And one of the main... They addressed two issues. So one was whether or not he had a claim against the doctor, the UCLA, and then two biotech companies that they had contracted with to use the cell lines for sort of breach of fiduciary duty.
Right.
And the court said yes with respect to the doctor, but not any of the other parties. So they said because there was a doctor-patient relationship, doctors have a fiduciary duty to their patients. He wasn't told that the doctor had a potential conflict of interest, a financial one.
And it really messed up the doctor-patient relationship.
He could pursue a claim against that. And then the other part of it, the part that most people pay attention to and which is sort of the basis for everything else that we just talked about, is that he had also made a claim based on property rights, recognition of property rights in his own cells and tissues. And the court said, no, that you don't have a property right in your own cells and tissues. In a sense, that paved the way for allowing other people to acquire property in patient cells and tissues.
Now, I imagine that this is plenty of articles to write on this topic.
Because, oh, yeah, there are many.
Because right up to today, this is something that's still being litigated. And I think it might be quite a shock to the listeners to learn that you don't own your body.
You know? You might own it while it's still all in one piece, but
all
once something's been removed, then maybe not.
Maybe not. And that's a sobering thought. And it's also, in many ways, a capitalistic thought as well, as we were talking about before, where body parts are made into this capitalistic system, very much so in this case. So what did he get from the, you know, what was the what was the restitution in terms of the patient, you know, the patient relationship there, the patient-doctor relationship, which really was quite distorted? Did the poor guy get anything?
So that's not on record.
It's not on record.
Yeah.
Aha, too bad. So we'll have to see. We'll have to find out what happened to him. So the question then becomes, what should we be doing as a society with this? I'm wondering whether you have some suggestions to how do we, many of our listeners, I think, are going to deal with this at some time in their life.
Oh, yeah.
So how should we be, how should we think about this? Should we feel good that our body parts will be used in research and that in sometimes we like to think that the UCLA hospital does important research and cures people and that the good, I mean, it also reminds me a little bit of the difference between this and the famous Henrietta Lacks case where her blood was, and she never got a
cell line was created from herself.
All of that. So, you know, what should we be looking for in terms of how do you think we should regulate it and think about it today?
Yeah, it's hard. I don't have a hard and fast sort of response to that. I think on the one hand, the concern is not just about sort of creating space for the value of altruism. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what's going on is that we have various types of rules, including organ donation rules, which say these should all be gifts because we want to have space in society for people to make sort of the ultimate gift, right?
Absolutely.
To other people.
Yes.
But I think the other part of it is that if we allow payment, if we allow the commercialization of human cells and tissues, then we might change for the worse what it means to be human. We might end up commodifying the value of human life.
Exactly.
So that's a competing concern. On the other hand, if you want to fully protect people like John Moore and Henrietta Lacks, maybe informed consent is not enough. Maybe you give them something like a property right that they can make a gift of if they choose to, but they can also defend by claiming property rights.
Well, I think this is a very important question for society. And I'm interested in the number of movies I've seen that since I was reading your material, it seemed to me to be trying to think about this. For example, I can't remember the name of the movie where the guy sees a woman and recognizes and learns, falls in love with her and doesn't understand why, but she had gotten his wife's eyes and therefore he falls in love with her and it works out very happily. So, you know, and stories like that where somehow giving an organ is held up as being, as you say, a tremendous altruistic moment of humanity, where in a movie for the moviegoers, this is a moment where we all feel good at the same time. And think of how many of those feel good stories there are. But also it does include a rather mystical or magical idea that this helped him figure out, start over again, because he got the same woman twice in two different forms through the. And it just seems like it's pretty crazy, irrational thinking about what organ donation is really all about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it shows, you know, maybe another way of thinking about that is that it shows that, you know, how we think of ourselves is something more than just a series of body parts that can be pieced together and valued in the market. There are other kinds of values that we invest in ourselves and in others and our relationships.
Mm-hmm. But it does also ask a very complicated philosophical question of, you know, what does it mean to fall in love with somebody and how do the organs carry some part of that person forward. And I actually think movies like this are probably thinking about this because people know about this. You know, people know about organ donation, so they're very interested in this and trying to figure this out, which is not exactly the same as the legal questions that you bring, but this sort of this mix between sort of an irrational notion that, you know, I can think of several cases of people I know myself who have had organ donation and then have been attached and have grown close to the people who've gotten the organs from the people in their family and somehow feel that same kind of magical connection as well. But where are we left today, magical thinking aside, trying to control my interest in magical thinking, just in terms of the legality of this all, if you were trying to explain to somebody now, then the more decision kind of set in motion, this idea that when you give some part of your body away, it becomes part of this capitalistic system and it is owned by the other person, at least so long as you can show informed consent. And then you add saying, I don't know whether your idea that we should have something more, is that reflected in legal system now? I mean, are they asking, or is this just something you're sort of, your own mystical version of maybe we need to have something more than informed consent?
Well, I think both. So informed consent can be done in all different ways.
Uh-huh.
So it could be that you get this, you know, nowadays, if you go through any kind of procedure where they're going to remove tissue, for example, right, even for a biopsy, right? You're going to get a long form. And it might be that buried in the middle of one of those paragraphs is a line that says that if you go to UC Davis Medical Center or UCLA Medical Center, right, that they're going to keep and they might use it for something that becomes valuable, right? And if that's true, most people aren't going to notice that line.
Yes.
Which isn't really informed consent, but it becomes enforceable because you signed the piece of paper.
Yes.
Right? You could do it much better, right? Certainly, you could separate out that language and make it clear to the person. And surveys show that many people who are asked outright in very express, clear terms, would you be willing to contribute your cells, your tissue, your DNA, right, in the hopes that it will be become useful, right, in scientific research, that many, if not most people, would say yes.
Yes.
Right? They would make that gift.
But they'd like to know that that's what they're saying.
Yeah, and I think giving them the opportunity to make that gift knowledgeably, expressly, is important of itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so what you're saying is that issue is occurring more in legal issues now, or it's just on the cusp? But right now, we're still pretty much in the Moore world, and that has still sort of...
We're right in the middle of a huge discussion about this, in part because we're building these huge biobanks, genes, microbiome. There are all these big, almost national projects,
mm-hmm.
To collect, vast repositories of human cells and tissues for purposes of big data research.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in the middle of that debate.
So stay tuned, because it's going to be a big debate. We're going to see, do you have to put informed consent in bigger letters on those forms? And if that isn't enough, do we need to do a couple other things? We've come to the end of the second segment of Office Hour. We will be back in just a bit with the final segment for today. So stay tuned. So welcome back. This is the third and final segment on Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we're talking with Lisa Ikimoto today about the interaction between the complex American legal system and reproductive rights. And we would, of course, be amiss if we finished off the show without talking about abortion issues. And so I want to talk a little bit about one of your papers, Abortion, Contraception, and the ACA. The realignment of women's health, which is certainly a topic that pretty much is in the news every single day these days, it seems. And what you talk about is that abortion is the only medical procedure that's banned from federal Medicaid funding. And I think trying to understand how that happened tells us a lot about how reproductive rights sort of fit into health care. I know in some countries, abortion is considered primarily a health issue. But in America, as you mentioned, the federal law mirrors a religious position. So we have a very complicated mix. And I was wondering if you could kind of sort of help us understand how we ended up with abortion being the only medical procedure banned from federal Medicaid funding and reflecting a religious position. How did we get there from where we were in the 70s?
So It happened in the 1970s. So Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade in 1973, and almost immediately there was a political backlash in the name of morality. And what's interesting is sort of the sort of story that was told to criticize and challenge the right of women to have access to abortions has changed over time.
Yes.
So in the 1970s, the primary focus of the attack was about sort of traditional family roles. So there was concern about the sexual revolution and that abortion would undermine the traditional role of men and women or husbands and wives in marriage. And then the emphasis shifted in the 1980s to focus on fetal life the notion of fetal personhood, right? And some version of that has persisted since then, even though other sort of themes have emerged.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly the moment of social change, which I think is so interesting, where you're at one point you're talking about women's health, and that the next minute you're talking about the rise of this idea of the death of the fetus as being the defining moment. Even though, again, I think that's important to point out that that is in my mind, something that's closer to a religious position, because not all religions have the same attitude towards the status of the fetus. So how does that happen? I mean, you went by that kind of quickly.
Okay.
And in 73, just because I think it's fascinatingly important and so central to the debate today, how did it happen that we went from women's health to then the position of the fetus sort of preempting the health role of abortion? You're saying it's partly, it was just a religious backlash against Roe versus Wade itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a broader sort of social, traditional social conservatism that was a backlash. And one thread of that was probably largely at that time a Catholic sort of attack on Roe versus Wade. And the law that was passed that said no federal funding for Medicaid, no federal dollars for Medicaid, was in place by the end of the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of shift in it was so entrenched in the very conception. And I think in a certain kind of way, they won out with the discourse, the rhetoric of the death of the fetus as being the way in which the discussion was then shaped. So that's continued up till today, with now some pressure also on the question of whether you can even have contraception kind of being added onto that as well recently. So where does that leave us now then in terms of the abortion debate? How can we think about this in terms of the relationship between law, as you mentioned, and reproductive health? Is it possible to even imagine going back and kind of rethinking the entire relationship between law and health issues at this point? Or do you think that we're past that, you know, where that kind of moment has passed in American society?
Oh, no, I don't think it's passed. I believe in change.
Okay.
Totally believe in change and fighting for change. And I think even the history since the 1970s demonstrates that there have been sort of, you know, much more rights protective moments, and there have been much more rights restrictive moments.
Yes.
During the past few decades. And right now we're at a moment when it's one of the most rights restrictive moments.
Yes.
But there's also a huge pushback against that at this time, and it's been building.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think there's hope. And I think part of it goes back to something you said at the very beginning of our discussion was, you know, abortion is a health service. And it's one of a wide range of comprehensive health services. So part of what's happened off and on during the past few decades is it's been segregated out from the notion of health and health care as if it's something very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
So one type of effort that can be made is to sort of push it back. It's an important public health measure.
Mm-hmm.
And should be included as part of our definition of what we mean by comprehensive health care. And I think the other part of it is just about the status of women. It's about should be tied to achieving equality, gender equality in society.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, but it seems very tricky to me. And I'm just interested in, for example, in comparison to the attitudes towards unwelcoming of among young people of different kinds of lifestyles, including being gay. I mean, that's kind of an issue that's become totally moot among many young people. In other words, there's a strong generational shift that within one generation we've seen a liberalizing of attitudes on sexuality, and in my lifetime we've seen a change about that. But we're not seeing that in terms of an old people versus young people around issues of abortion. And that's what I meant about sort of how do we rethink whether we might have to rethink the whole question of abortion in a certain kind of way, because it isn't going along with a generational shift where younger people see it more as being an issue of health care. And I don't know whether that has to do in your mind with something about, again, how law fits into American society and how law interacts with things that are not law, things that are social values. And if you can sort of bring any insights to us on this as someone who studied the legal standing.
I mean, I think law by itself, it's a prod, but it has to be accompanied by a social movement. So, I believe in grassroots work around this, and there is a lot of work. So, for example, right now, there's a bill in the California legislature that would require that medication be abortion be provided in student health clinics
yes.
in the Cal State and UC system.
Yes.
And I think in California we can make that happen. And that's part it's being framed as part of the effort to make sure that students have access to the full range of healthcare mm-hmm. services that they need.
Mm-hmm. So it's very much along the lines of saying that the law has to be about health and not about religion. Would you say that would be one way of
I think part of it. I mean, there should be room for, you know, religion in our society as an individual matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is to what extent one particular religious perspective is being imposed on everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really where we need the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that many people, including the young generation, gets.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested also in whether you think this is another example of the eliding of the male role in pregnancy that we were talking about earlier on the show, that somehow abortion is also tied in to, I think you're absolutely right about the whole question of health, but that it's also tied into something about the extra role of female blame around pregnancy. And that is an elusive topic, as we've seen, for law to address. And is that, or maybe we shouldn't, in the bill you're talking about doesn't even try to address elusive male roles in pregnancy. It just says, let's not even talk about it. Let's just talk about availability on campuses, and that we should go that way. So is there something in there in terms of what you think, how we actually bring about social change on this? There's some things that are just not worth trying to go for.
Oh, no, I think we should go for it. But I think it's, you know, like, it's like what I always tried to say before, although not very well, is that we have to think in terms of, you know, equality and social justice. So there are broader goals, not just sort of what healthcare services are available to whom, but our commitments to equality and social justice shape how we think about what healthcare services should be available and to whom.
Well, is there any way for the law to try to deal with the question of the eliding of the male role in pregnancy?
Yeah, we could have laws that actually protect people who become pregnant. We have some, but they're not particularly generous.
If we were just sort of having a legal moment of free association and wild thinking, you
yeah.
know, what would a law look like that took into account the fact that women don't make themselves pregnant?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally that's a different answer to a different question.
Maybe it's just not going to happen.
It's
legally hard to imagine.
I think that the law is the tool of how we reconceptualize, but I don't think it's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should be looking.
It's one strategy we would
yeah.
use.
Well, it's so maybe we should be thinking of other ways in which other parts of society in which it might be possible to sort of realizing the male role in pregnancy.
It's culture change that we need.
Culture change. Yeah. And then you'll be able to bring it into through law cases, and then we'll be talking about
Hopefully.
It, and they'll be litigating all kinds of things. You know, I don't know. It's a very a very broad, unanswerable question now, but one that I think is worth posing, because I do think we see that law does pick up on magical thinking and things like that in certain points. So I'm gonna leave that for the listeners. I think we're all gonna. That's one of our questions. How might the law take into consideration some of the things we've been talking about in all three segments today? We constantly see that reproductive rights, where it intersects with law, has a lot to do with the tremendous gendering of mothering, as you started out at the beginning talking about that pregnancy almost is as if it is only a female activity. It's only responsible for women, and only women can be blamed. And how do we even go about rethinking that?
Yeah, I mean, it's about sort of challenging our assumptions in which we equate sort of biological abilities with social roles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And or it just because there still is a biological role that is just not embodied in the same way, and therefore it just seems it's kind of got off scot-free. Mm-hmm. So terrific. Well, thank you very much. I really want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And so as always, if you want to listen to the show again, it'll be on officehourucdpodcast.com. That's officehourucdpodcast.com. And this show and other shows will be archived there. And there will be a link to Lisa Akimoto's law school webpage, where I assume our listeners can get information and copies of articles and read more about this so they can get the material there. And we will be back next week knocking on somebody else's door. So we hope that you come back next week and join us then. So until then, have a great week. Bye.